I think overall, there's kind of optimism around the change in government, a sense that actually Keir Starmer is serious about resetting relations with the EU, and that that means that there must be some wiggle room and change on the EU side as well, but within limits, which I'm sure we'll come to.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is a series of podcasts brought to you by AIG in partnership with some of the world's leading centres of expertise on global trade. Visit www.aig.com/GTS. The series moderator is Rem Korteweg of the Klingendahl Institute.
Hello and welcome to the AIG Global Trade Series 2024. This is your host, Rem Korteweg from the Klingendahl Institute in sort of sunny The Hague. And today's topic is towards a reset in EU-UK relations, ? Since Labour's electoral victory last July, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has committed himself to a reset of the EU-UK relationship. This is not surprising, since 3.5 years since the EU and the UK negotiated their trade and cooperation agreement, popular support in the UK for Brexit has steadily fallen. Delays at the border to clear goods, a drop in foreign investment, labour shortages, and inflation have all to some degree been exacerbated by Britain's departure from the EU single market. Now, on top of this, the context has shifted as both the EU and the UK worry about competitiveness, climate change, industrial strength, while geopolitics on the European continent has taken a turn for the worse with the war in Ukraine. And so a closer relationship between these two regional trading powers would seem to make sense. Though falling short of saying he wants to reverse Brexit, Keir Starmer has said that he wants to, quote, reset our relationship with the EU and make Brexit work for the British people. Well, what exactly would that mean? In this podcast, we want to bring you up to speed on where things stand on EU-UK affairs, the possibility of a reset in the relationship, the perspectives of some of the key countries involved, and what this might actually mean for the trade relationship moving forward. And to help make sense of this, I'm joined by three trade experts, Brexit watchers, and three friends. Firstly, from Paris, I'm joined by Georgina Wright. Georgina is Senior Fellow and Deputy Director for International Studies at Institut Montaigne. She focuses on France's European policy, Franco-British relations, US-EU links, and the future of the EU. She was also Senior Researcher at London's Institute for Government and a Research Associate at Chatham House. She really straddles both sides of the channel with her expertise. Secondly, from Berlin, I'm joined by Nikolai von Ondarza. He is the head of the EU Research Division at the Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik, SWP, and among his research interests has been EU-UK relations before, during, and after the Brexit talks. He recently published a report entitled The UK and the EU, New Opportunities and Old Obstacles, Prospects for UK-EU Cooperation in Foreign and Security Policy After the UK Elections. So very topical indeed. And last, but certainly not least, from London, I'm joined by David Hennig. David is the director of the UK Trade Policy Project at the European Centre for International Political Economy. He is an authority on UK trade policy and relations with the EU, and is the author of a very recent report entitled Negotiating Uncertainty in UK-EU Relations, Past, Present, and Future, a report that sketches out some of the opportunities and obstacles both sides will have to grapple with. And he offers a dose of realism on what can be expected. And that means he is perfect to have on this conversation. So it's great to have all three of you here, though I am slightly intimidated to be surrounded by so much EU-UK and Brexit expertise. But let's dive right in. David, can I start with you? I mean, how would you describe, on the one hand, the current state of EU-UK trade relations, and on the other, the mood in London regarding a possible reset?
Thanks, Rem, and there's no need for you to be feeling in any way inadequate as another keen watcher of the subject. Where I think, if we go back 18 months, Under Rishi Sunak, the UK and the EU signed the Windsor Framework relating to Northern Ireland. And that was really important because, in a sense, that drew a line under the absolute worst of the antagonism that had happened through the whole Brexit process. An agreement was made. The UK agreed to abide by it with regard to Northern Ireland. The UK subsequently joined the Horizon Science Research Programme. We were into a better place. Now, that didn't immediately add up to much change at the political level. What happened was that slowly, at the more technical level, working relations were improving. And I think what happened was that both sides realised the full scale of the task. There were all manner of small engagements out of the public eye, really. Both sides talking to each other about what they were doing. Some of them a little bit more obvious, like cooperation on economic security, particularly with regard to sanctions on Russia. Many of them less so, just day-to-day working contacts around barriers to trade in SPS, food and agricultural trade, movement of people. Fast forward then to the election. Labour is a more internationalist and pro-EU party, but has a quite cautious approach to the reset. Not joining a single market or joining a customs union, no return to freedom of movement, but seeking instead smaller improvements such as on an SPS deal, a security deal, better mobility for touring artists, professional qualifications. That's not necessarily the limit of their ambitions, but that was how it was summed up in the manifesto.
We'll get into the detail of what might be expected with the conversation about a reset, what can be real deliverables. But could you just describe kind of what the current mood is? I mean, do people really expect that a massive change can be made, or is it really tinkering in the margins?
When it comes to the mood, at a political level, it's reasonable. So there's a lot of engagement now going on between UK ministers and Commission and EU counterparts, a lot more than we've seen before. At a sort of commentariat level, quite a bit of scepticism as to whether, one, any of this would make much of an economic difference, two, how much is really negotiable once you get beyond the smiles and the handshakes at the political level. So a certain degree of uncertainty, and that's not surprising because we've had a lot of trauma in the last 8 years. So there's a further thing to think about. How much do people in the UK really want to reopen the EU debate in a big way? Not clear that they do. So a fairly cautious approach is probably in line with the mood in London. So a certain sense of cautious optimism, but nothing much more than that.
And Georgina, I mean, what's the mood in Paris like? I mean, are people still talking about Brexit? Are they expecting a lot from the reset? Is this something that is capturing headlines?
No, it's not capturing headlines at all, but that's because the state of French politics is quite messy at the moment. We obviously have a new French government led by Michel Barnier. So for those who followed Brexit closely will know he was the lead Brexit negotiator and, you know, managed to sort of achieve that UK-EU deal on the EU side. But no one's talking about Brexit at all. In fact, people had stopped talking about Brexit even before the deal had been achieved. That being said, I think the attention sort of taken away from Brexit is possibly a good thing because it means that, you know, France fully supports the EU Commission, knows it will do a good job, will be kept in the loop. And, you know, the less sort of political attention is focused on that, the more kind of space you're giving negotiators to have those talks around what is feasible from a technical standpoint, and then what, of course, is feasible from a political standpoint. That being said, there are important decisions that need to be made in the next couple of years. So I'm thinking around fisheries, which is, of course, really contentious between France and the UK, energy cooperation as well, and whether we can facilitate flows. And those are tricky discussions, you know, which France is going to be very much, if not sitting around the table, very much in the next room, making sure its view is being heard and supported. But I think overall, there's kind of optimism around the change in government, a sense that actually Keir Starmer is serious about resetting relations with the EU, and that means that there must be some wiggle room and change on the EU side as well, but within limits, which I'm sure we'll come to in a bit.
Yeah, and thanks so much. And Nikolai, I mean, just from your vantage point in Berlin, of course, Germany, the home of the famous German car industry that would have delivered a massive beneficial deal to the UK during the Brexit talks. Where do people think the EU-UK relationship can be improved? Is this something that's on the radar, or is it all again, sort of covered up because of German domestic political debate.
Yes, in a sense, it's quite similar to the situation in Paris. So the German government is in a mess at the moment. There's lots of political attention on internal politics. And if people talk about foreign relations, it's, of course, about the war in Ukraine, about the Middle East. And I would say since the Windsor Agreement, the UK has been crossed off the list of problems, but it has not necessarily been put on the list of opportunities, at least for the wider public. For the government, this is a little bit different. Olaf Scholz, the chancellor, has quite a lot of connections to Keir Starmer, and there's SPD, Labour connections that developed even before the elections. So there is the ambition of the German government to sign a bilateral treaty with the UK by the end of this year, because we have elections next year and the treaty should go through the German parliament before that. And so at least on the administrative expert level, the conversation is picking up again, both about what can be done on the UK-EU level, but also what Germany and the UK can do bilaterally and how these two can relate to each other.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I want to come back to that bilateral agreement in a bit. I just want to get your thoughts first on this very basic question, which I think we all sort of glance over or perhaps avoid discussing too deliberately, which is, why is a reset necessary? Why is this desirable? What are the opportunities that we need to be thinking about? And perhaps, David, because the UK is really putting this on the agenda, you can start off by giving us what the rundown is from a UK perspective. Like, why is this reset necessary or important?
I think there's a few things in that. Clearly, the trade barriers that came as a result of Brexit are prominent. Goods trade has dropped, goods exports, smaller exporters are disadvantaged. So there is an element of that. Equally, a realization of just how much is involved in the UK-EU relationship. So Georgina mentioned energy. Energy has become a huge issue in the last few years and isn't really sufficiently covered in the TCA. And that's even before you get things coming up like linking the emissions trading scheme with a view to avoiding carbon border adjustment payments. So you've just seen this enormous scope and just the sheer number of issues coming up. And then a third way is just frankly that the relationship has been somewhat dysfunctional. You just haven't had connections at any level of depth between politicians, a few more between officials, but not many. I suppose there's one other thing I would mention, which is Northern Ireland. I'm conscious when I go to Brussels and to Berlin, Northern Ireland is not considered a finished and done deal. There's recognition the Windsor framework is a little bit fragile. It's never been fully accepted there. So that keeps both sides also wanting to make things closer. So I think there are a number of reasons for this. And even there's one which is more Brussels, but London keeps an eye on as well. The geopolitical situation for the EU and frankly, the opportunity for new agreements is not great. So you look at it and think, well, actually, the UK is an opportunity here. So the reset is the right thing to offer at the right time to an EU that perhaps doesn't have a lot of offers on the table at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, which I also want to test with Georgina and Nikolai, is that the public conversation seems to be that the UK is putting this on the agenda, as if the UK would be the demandeur. But what's actually the broader European, the EU interest? How do we get the EU to prioritize thinking about a EU-UK relationship? What's in it for the EU, and perhaps what's in it for France and Germany?
I can start maybe first by saying reset is also in some sense a British PR term. I think 50% of the reset already happened from a German perspective with the Windsor Agreement. That was really before that the low point of British-EU relations, and that from Berlin's side already fixed some of the issues and cooperation already ticked up with the Sunak administration. And I think the bits that Germany is now looking at is certainly the security side. We mentioned Russia's war against Ukraine. Of course, all of us are looking at the US in November. And so there is this overarching theme in Germany that we need to invest more in our security. And if we do that on the European scale, the British need to be involved. And also the question about the further aspirations about European defense sense how the British can be linked into there. And I think this is certainly an interest from a German side. A second interest is about mobility. So mobility between the EU and the UK has suffered quite a lot for students, for skilled pupils, for people who want to work in the UK. So this is something that I think Germany wants to put on the table. What hasn't changed, though, are the fundamental red lines from a German perspective, in the sense that the UK, if it wants to have deeper access to parts of the single market, then it would need to accept EU regulations. And as the UK government has continued to rule out single market customs union membership, at least the impression in Berlin is that in terms of the economic conversations, it's part of minor adjustment here and there, but not really a big movement or big negotiations completely overhauling the trade and cooperation agreement, rather adding to it in areas that have so far not been covered, like the security foreign affairs side.
Yeah, great. And Georgina, from the French perspective, where's the upside in a EU-UK reset? And also, if you can also shed some light on whether you think that the EU, the new commission, might be similarly inclined, that would be great.
I mean, pretty much when Nicolai is talking, I'm sort of nodding in violent agreement, because I feel that Berlin and Paris are quite close on the issue of Brexit. They're very different and very far apart on many other issues, but I think on Brexit, they see eye to eye.
That's a good thing.
Yes, very much so. In Paris, you know, the talk is of improving the deal, not resetting it. And I think that's absolutely key. And when you ask sort of French officials what they mean by that, you know, they talk about starters, very technical things. So, you know, the border management, because, you know, of course, everyone's got those scenes of the summer where you've got travellers on either side blocked at the border for hours and hours and hours, but also goods not making it through in a decent amount of time. There have been improvements and they're trying to kind of bring in new technology to try and speed that up. But I think there's definitely more that can be done there. And then, of course, mobility, which is what Nicolai was talking about. How do you enable basically students, for example, who study in the UK, can they stay on? How long can they stay on, etc. But, you know, there are limits to that, in the sense of you can try and improve the deal as much as possible, grant the UK greater access to the single market and vice versa, but you've got to do it within reason. I mean, you've got countries like Norway that are basically not members of the EU, but sort of copy-paste EU legislation to make sure that they can export as much as they'd like in terms of goods. Why would you make a special deal for the UK which doesn't require that dynamic alignment? So we come back into hurdles. I think where there might be, and this is the question on the Commission being more open to maybe discussing things it hadn't been open to in 2016, is that the world is a very different place right now, and trade is not a popular thing anymore. We've got China and the United States basically massively propping up their industrial policy, distorting sort of global trade rules, and that makes the EU, I think about its own kind of single market and how can you work with neighbouring countries that have similar views about trade, and also in those new spaces of innovation like artificial intelligence and stuff like that, which we know the UK is doing great work on. So I think there is willingness and appetite, but again, always within limits.
I was going to say, nobody's mentioned really competitiveness, the Draghi report, these sort of things. Is that just because we've kind of given up on trade as a route to competitiveness? But it's quite interesting the way this is framed. It's true as of the UK as well. Nobody's really seeing this as sort of helping to drive far greater growth in the in Europe as a whole. Something missing there from the picture.
Well, absolutely. And since this is a trade podcast, I mean, we it might be good to sort of get your thoughts on where real improvement in trade flows can be expected. So perhaps that's a nice segue to trying to unpack where a reset could have material ramifications, like where could we really see progress? And all three of you have mentioned a couple of things, whether it's mobility, the energy relationship, SPS, so a sanitary or phytosanitary agreement. There's the question you put on the table, David, regarding a carbon border adjustment mechanism that might be able to facilitate trade between the EU and the UK. Is there any low-hanging fruit? I mean, are there any easy options that the Commission and number 10 should work on first? And perhaps, David, I mean, you wrote a recent report which kind of addresses this question. So over to you.
I mean, there's never any absolutely easy ones. The lowest of the hanging fruit, it really is on the UK side, which is regulatory alignment. If the UK commits, particularly across wide areas of goods, to say we're going to align with EU rules, that is immediately taking out a chunk of cost for business and making it easier to trade and increasing confidence. Also, if you're making long-term investments. In terms of technical improvements, the UK could also join the Pan-EuroMed Convention on Rules of Origin. That is the accumulation between all the countries in the region, with the exception of the UK. That's something that the neighbours of the other neighbours of the EU, like Switzerland, are asking the UK to do. It's not on the UK's list, but it makes a difference. None of these things individually.
David, what would that do?
What it allows in effect is that it allows in goods trade, you can take inputs from any of the countries, then export them more easily to any of the other countries. So, for example, there's a chemicals company that I was speaking to recently who export into the EU and then for further export onto to Serbia after some processing. That all becomes a lot easier if the UK joins PEM. I've also heard it from importers who use European distribution hubs that they come in, say, from Morocco into France, into the UK. That's difficult if you don't have accumulation of rules of origin that allow that to all happen at zero tariff. So neither of those are game changers, but they both help to facilitate this. And it's the same across the board, because if we think about energy, a lot of it is in sort of preventing barriers that haven't yet come up, like the carbon border adjustment mechanism payments. It's not necessarily that it would radically improve trade, but I suspect what you're trying to do through a whole lot of these things together is just make steps across the piece to improve the trading environment, improve the stability of relations, and just encourage businesses to do more trade on a much more solid basis.
Yeah, but what you're saying, and I want to bring it to Nikolai and Georgina, is basically these are things that the UK can already unilaterally do. It can already take a step to recognize or to pursue regulatory alignment. It can by itself already decide to join PEM. But it's not a bilateral EU-UK thing, if you will. And so if you listen to this from an EU perspective, you could say, well, the ball is very much in the UK's court. What does the EU want to do to improve that trading relationship? I mean, just from my vantage point here in the Netherlands, I know that there is a keen interest to engage with the UK on energy issues, on energy flows, very similar to what Georgina said, but you ought very quickly run up against the confines of the TCA. Is there room from a German perspective or a French perspective to push the EU Commission to be perhaps a little bit more flexible, or to kind of find where we can push the envelope in terms of things that we think are already set in stone with the TCA?
I mean, yes, but I don't think, again, the political attention has been really set on how do you improve the TCA. So, you know, of course, I think France will be supportive of improvements. But you, as David said, there's a sense, and as you said, Ren, there's a sense that, oh, it's the ball's in the UK's court, which I actually don't think is good enough, especially if you think about a world in which trade is just not popular anymore. And there are things that you need. So, you know, when you look at von der Leyen, the European Commission president's speech in front of the European Parliament, she says we want to be a clean tech powerhouse. Well, that makes no sense of thinking about clean tech innovation without including the UK. And, you know, if you were the UK, you'd think, well, great about cooperating and partnerships, but is there a way that we can include that in the TCA? What could we get in return for that? And also, I think in terms of services, because we look at goods, because that's kind of easier to kind of quantify. But if you look at the UK services, it's outperformed, I think, almost every other advanced economy over the past 5 years. And it's not just because of its financial services. You also have like other business services, such as, I think, legal services and management, you know, consultancy and accountancy and all of those things. And I think the EU really needs to do, it's already started, but doing a map of what does it need to be a 22nd century global kind of market economy competitive powerhouse, and how can it work with the UK to achieve that? And I think those sorts of conversations haven't really started. All the focus is on the US and China, the deficit there, what we need to catch up on, and there's not enough thinking about what the EU can do with neighbouring countries.
Can I come back on that? Because I think that when you say, Rem, those are all things the UK could do, there's a little bit of an elaborate dance here. So yes, the UK can do things, and some of them it probably should do, but it kind of helps if also the EU is thinking in the same way. So you set up otherwise people start worrying, oh, well, we could do that, but what if we might get something in return, or what if the EU ignores it? So you've really got to sort of bring together these things. So if the EU starts to show signs of thinking as Georgina suggests, the UK starts to do things like I'm suggesting, you're sort of, although it doesn't look like negotiations as normal, actually that's a good thing.
And isn't the analogy of the dance quite apt here, that there is an element of choreography that needs to be aligned and that timelines also need to be aligned? And I want to bring in Nikolai on this as well, that I think what all of you are saying is that maybe the UK is ready to talk about this, whether it's formal negotiation or behind the scenes. But on the EU side, we're still trying to figure out what our priorities are, whether it's the focus on the US or on China, and we have the new commission, we have our own domestic political problems. So how do we get the EU in a position that it is the right dance partner for the UK at this moment? Nikolai.
Yeah, so my fear is that there are Brexit wounds not only in UK public discourse, but also within the EU administration. And one of that Brexit wound is that whenever the EU offers something to the UK, has in the past almost immediately been rejected, but then pocketed as sort of a gain also for the next step of the next negotiations. And we saw that with the ill-fated idea about youth mobility that the EU discussed within itself during the UK election campaign. It was immediately rejected by Labour, but is now almost sort of the base case if we talk about youth mobility, if the EU were to make some concessions there. And this is why I think this phrase, the ball is in the UK's court, is very much a reflection of the fear in the EU circle that if the EU now moves, the UK will immediately take that and say, thank you very much. And I think what we really need to do is get out of this Brexit mindset and treat the UK, for lack of a better word, like any old third country that is very close to us, that is big, that is important, but that is not an ex-member, but that is a partner to work with. And I think that step still needs to be done. And this is, for me, the task of the next commission. And this brings me to the question of timelines that you raised, Rem. And here, I also am afraid that the EU timelines work a little bit against the UK timelines, in the sense that the new commission needs to be set up. We expect that at the earliest, I would say now by 1st of December, it could even slip into next year. And from an EU level, I think the real work on the reset, negotiating a new partnership, can only start with the new commission. And there, what my hope is that Keir Starmer will visit Brussels in early October and speak with Ursula von der Leyen, and they can maybe sort of get a reset in terms of mindset. Say, we're starting a new conversation about a future partnership of two important partners, and we're not renegotiating Brexit. And if we can really get that into the minds, both in Brussels and in London, then I think we can take the next step in this careful dance of trying to find new different bits and pieces where the two sides can work together with each other. And then maybe countering a little bit your previous question, I think the easiest path to start there is talking about security, because security is not directly tied to the single market. This has some connections to it, but is not as closely connected to the single market. And where I think the case for an EU-UK cooperation is clearest from the EU side, where it really has an interest in this sort of difficult European security environment to bring the UK closer. And this is why I think this would be an excellent area to maybe step by step come into a new situation where we're really talking about the partnership rather than renegotiating Brexit.
But on security, I mean, yes, I think the geopolitical context is very important, and it's driving this discussion to have a more structural conversation between the EU and the UK on European security. But European security very quickly goes into economic security, and that gets you to the energy file. And then you very quickly, once you go down that slope, actually run up against the TCA. I'm just curious to see how we manage that process. But I agree with you that as a low-hanging fruit, if you will, the security dialogue would be very important. Another element that all three of you are actually saying, and I want to spell that out, is simply having the conversation and showing that both sides are serious to talk to each other again is a confidence-building measure that could be considered low-hanging fruit. It's simply have that more structural conversation. Summitry does have value in and of itself. A question I have, however, is when we want to get down to the nitty-gritty detail, what kind of timelines are we thinking of and when results can be delivered? And I've heard various different ideas about this flying around. For instance, if a youth mobility deal needs to be agreed or an SPS agreement, how much time are we looking at to negotiate that? And does Keir Starmer have the time to do that now that we know that he's currently in sort of his honeymoon period?
Many a relationship that started with political goodwill founders on the negotiating details. And I'm sure I first met Rem when I was when we were both looking at the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the US and the UK. Not to say that I'm scarred by that. That is a reason, I think, why you need to actually have a make a range of activities, some of which are merely cooperative to start with, more dialogues, etc., in order to create what sometimes diplomats call load-bearing structures. Because essentially, those negotiations, when it actually comes down to it, are not, none of them are going to be easy. Take security. Take whether the UK is going to have access to EU defence funds. That is absolutely not an easy question. Take SPS. I've been, you know, somebody who knows this situation well has given me the names of two people inside the commission who are likely to block any agreement, and been told that, you know, building trust would take some years. Youth mobility. Okay, I can see the outline of how a youth mobility scheme might work, but the UK comes back to the EU and says, okay, that's fine. We'll give you, I don't know, 10,000 places youth mobility. We'll not divide them up by member state. I'm not quite sure. And the EU might say, well, that's not quite how we want it to work. And we want it unlimited, or we want this and that. So there's this huge amount of detail to go under the surface. Energy, it took Switzerland 7 years to link their emissions trading scheme with the EU. Now, I'm told some of that was on the Swiss side about sort of there were problems in the wider relationship. But yeah, all of this takes time. Therefore, I think you've got to kind of set various things rolling, create the structures which start with a regular summit and regular coordination, and just see how many you can actually land, because some of them you're not going to.
Yeah. Is this also where some of the bilateral deals come in? And Georgina, I know that the UK and France have been talking to each other. They, of course, have a very long bilateral tradition to fall back on. But could these bilateral deals that the UK is negotiating, either with Germany, France, and others, act as these flying buttresses to create an environment for a more structural dialogue with the EU?
I mean, you'd hope so, wouldn't you? If you looked at the last sort of statement from the Franco-British summit, they clearly talk about youth mobility. They talk about improving the TCA. So there's a lot of political will. But then, as you said, Ren, you come to the kind of obstacle of domestic politics. Now, if you look at France, there's a new French government that took forever to put together, that parties in an incredibly divided French parliament, where the lower house says this government is absolutely not reflective of the last election results. And so a lot of focus is going to be on that. It's good. France faces an incredibly high deficit. And there are a lot of big problems that it's going to encounter at the EU level. I mean, now we're talking about France's deficit being 6% of GDP. These are the sorts of conversations that France is really going to, tricky conversations it's going to be having at the EU level. But I would really hope that if we are talking about improvements to the TCA, it will be well before 2027, because that's going to be an important year in the presidential election in France. Who knows who will be president? But if you look at the last presidential election, Marine Le Pen was very clear that she's not doing any favours to the UK. And if the UK did get a lot of favours that look quite attractive, maybe that would push the Rassemblement National in the other direction, which is to say, well, maybe we should leave the EU because actually it doesn't look so bad after all outside. So there are going to be tricky political obstacles and debates to navigate. But I think full support to the EU Commission is really the first starting point, and then being seen together, summit, doing more together, and then hopefully that will lead to improving the deal.
And Nicolai, how's that viewed in Berlin, where obviously Keir Starmer made one of his first foreign visits to Berlin? And there is this bilateral agreement that was presented. How is that featuring into this broader debate about a reset?
It features in the sense that there's a huge difference between the timeline for the British-German discussions and the British-EU discussions, because our next elections are scheduled for September next year. The German government is unsure whether it can survive until then. And so due to the connection between SPD and Labour, there is a great willingness to finish negotiations on the British-German treaty by the end of this year so that it can be ratified in early 2025. While, as we discussed earlier, the negotiations between the UK and the EU will not really start in earnest until next year. And so there are two questions for that. One, in how far will maybe the British-German deal pre-shadows some of the issues that might come up on the UK-EU side? And the second question is, where do we get the same sense of urgency on the UK-EU timetable? We don't have sort of both Keir Starmer and Ursula von der Leyen will be at the beginning of their mandates next year. And there is no sort of, at least for the time being, no clear finish line. And during the whole Brexit conversations, we had the cliff edge, we had the end of the transition phase, and there was always the urgency to find a deal between London and Brussels very quickly. And this time around, we are entering negotiations that are potentially open-ended. And to some extent, we probably can expect that the UK and the EU will have some sort of negotiations for the rest of time, basically. But for this upcoming reset, I think what we need is maybe sort of fix the summit by mid-2025 and say, until then, we want an agreement in policy area A, B, and C to create this dynamic momentum and sense of urgency, rather than sort of put these negotiations on the sort of second row back burner. And then my fear is that we will have only very slow, if at all, any progress.
So, I mean, just on coming back on that, two things. One, I think Germany has already made a tremendous contribution to the reset by a little bit facilitating sort of UK goodwill into the EU, into the Ursula von der Leyen team. So I think I think there has been some facilitation. I think that's really helped. Two, there are other member states who are going to push this quite hard. And I'm thinking Poland have the presidency in the first half of next year. And you know, Poland is committed to this reset, wants to do things within its presidency on the reset. So, you know, there's a chance for others to step up. But I'm afraid Nicolai ultimately is right. You know, this is an open-ended negotiation, so we can't get away from that. So it's then about how much can we agree structurally in the next year that places this on some kind of basis where the then forever relationship can sort of, you know, then start kind of taking on a life of its own.
And just for those of us who don't follow the German-British bilateral relationship as closely as you do, Nicolai, what are the key points in the treaty or agreement that's being discussed bilaterally?
So we don't know, of course, all the details so far. What's clear is that the starting point is security and defense. So it started also with the bilateral declaration of the two defense ministers. It's clear that there will be a cultural element. There will be government-to-government consultation, so an institutional elements of regular dialogue. And I expect some economic energy element. We have energy cooperation in the North Sea. And maybe the sort of open question and an area that we haven't mentioned so far that might be interesting is migration. The British are pushing very hard to put the fight against the criminal gangs facilitating migration over the channels as part into that agreement. And this might also be sort of an interesting area and interesting interplay between the UK and the EU side. But those are the areas that we're talking about at the moment. But the negotiations are not yet fully public and they are done under sort of this huge time pressure. So it will actually be also some surprises could come up when they actually get to an agreement by the end of this year.
So what you're all saying is that it's not actually a dance between two partners. It's a dance between two partners plus 27 others sort of standing around watching the dance take place and seeing which type of music they should be dancing to.
Certainly will also be a consultation between the 27 partners. So Germany will talk to the Commission and inform the other EU countries of these negotiations. But of course, at the end, it's a bilateral deal, not an EU-27 deal.
What are potential spoilers that could derail some of this? I mean, we've talked about the domestic politics, but are there any obvious sort of pitfalls that we can already recognize that the two sides, or the 27 plus one and the UK, should avoid?
I mean, I think the big one is domestic politics, for sure. Yeah. I think that's going to be the biggest derailer. And, you know, the other one that we were all talking about in 2016 was, there's a UK-US trade deal. What does that mean for UK-EU negotiations? What would that mean for UK-EU deal? Well, that doesn't look very likely. Even if Trump were to win, it looks like a UK-US trade deal would be very, very difficult to negotiate. So I think that's no longer an obstacle. So I really think it's going to be domestic politics. And, we shouldn't underestimate 27 countries with their own domestic politics, and the big member states completely consumed by internal division, big elections coming up. So it's good. That's going to be the really tricky bit, I think.
There is a report out recently, a survey of UK public opinion towards foreign policy and trade. And one question was, what would stop you wanting to trade more with the EU? Youth mobility? Nope, fine, we're happy with that. Would it be signing up to EU regulations? No, we're happy to do that. Would it be giving EU boats more access to UK fish? Yes, if that happens, we don't want more. We don't want more trade. I'm sort of describing that probably quite badly. But fish, it's the kind of small but incredibly powerful political issue. And if you take what Georgina just said about difficult domestic politics, these are the kind of communities that have an outsized importance. So you could, I could easily see the whole reset being derailed by fish. And I'm afraid that's not, that's serious.
I think that's actually a very plausible scenario as well. David, one thing, when does the current fish quota agreement run out?
2026. And it's also linked to, but it's also at the moment linked to the energy provisions, which also run out at the end of, in 2026 because of the lack of trust during the negotiations. So it was a sort of they were paired up to in a way because of the EU distrust of the UK. So that issue comes straight away, because if you're going to start talking about energy, you're delinking it from fish, at which point fish already becomes becomes an issue.
So I would just add mismanaged expectations to the equation, in the sense that I sometimes have the impression, talking to people from Labour, that they expect, just because they approach the EU with a different mindset, that they would get different concessions. And I can imagine a situation where the EU, for formal reasons, for instance, says in the security side, you can only take part under conditions A, B, C, D. And then Labour says, OK, these are completely unacceptable. And if we can't even get concessions from the EU on security side and can't even work together there, what's the point? So if we sort of build up wrong expectations and then the negotiation dynamics flounders, that I think could lead to an estrangement from Labour and the EU that we potentially have seen in other third countries like Norway or Switzerland, where even sort of those in favour of working with the EU have been disappointed by an EU that is just a hard bargainer and also bargains with elbows against its partners and friends, which are close by.
Okay, so I have to ask you a final question because we are slowly running out of time. If there is one thing you could ask the Commission to do and one thing you could ask the UK government to do to put us on the right footing, and I want to end on an optimistic note, what would that be? And it can be anything. It can be process. It can be in terms of personnel. It can be in terms of topics. It can be in terms of creating the right mood or what have you. What are your two key recommendations for the Commission and for number 10? Georgina.
I would say for the UK, appoint a good negotiating team that understands the EU, that understands the constraints the EU has, how it's a political body. I think to the EU, do a strategic mapping. You want to talk about competitiveness, how you remain a trade hub, how you remain a competitive hub in the 21st and 22nd century. What do you need to achieve that, and where can the UK help plug the gaps?
Perfect. David?
I am going for the same one on both sides. I want both sides to spend a huge amount more time managing their public messaging so that it actually is in some way coordinated, so we don't get rows blowing up, like about youth mobility, where the UK line is all wrong, like on the EU side, where they keep saying we're not reopening the TCA. There's all manner of unhelpful messaging going around, and it would not take very much for that to blow up unhelpfully. If you got to a situation, and actually this would follow on from Georgina's, because you'd need good negotiators and people who knew each other, you get to a situation where the two teams can actually talk to each other and sort of say, look, we're saying these sort of things, but actually, you know, this is what it means, and actually are coordinating their messaging to set the right expectations to all those stakeholders.
Perfect. Nikolai?
Yeah, just to add for the UK side, I would say avoid setting too many red lines too early in the process. So ruling out this or that, which makes the negotiations much harder. And for the EU side, avoid thinking about the UK in terms of all the other third country relationship, but treat it as a special case from a strategic perspective where the UK and the EU should develop a model for the UK specifically, rather than sliding it into all the different other relationships, which could also lead the EU to set too many red lines.
So all these are perfect recommendations, although at the same time, I have the feeling that we'll be talking about this for quite some time to come. Because I think, like David, in your recent publication, you also make the point that, you know, the relationship will never be complete or never be fully satisfied. There will always be things to talk about, which we will happily follow and feed into. I think I speak on behalf of all of us. Unfortunately, this is all we have time for today. Going by what you've all shared, it seems like 2025 is going to be an absolutely crucial year in terms of the EU-UK reset and what it looks like, and we'll be sure to keep tracking that. Thank you very much to Georgina Wright, David Hennig, and Nikolai von Ondarsa for talking to me today. This has been fantastic. So please check out our other conversations for the AIG Global Trade Series at www.aig.com/gts, or simply get them through your podcast app.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is an international partnership between AIG, the Aspen Institute, Germany, SEBRI, the Brazilian Center for International Relations, Chatham House, CITD, the Center on Inclusive Trade and Development at Georgetown University Law Center, the Klingendahl Institute, Elcano Royal Institute, AREA, the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia, ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, the Jacques Delors Institute, RIETI, the Research Institute of Economy, Trade and Industry, and the St. Gallen Endowment for Prosperity Through Trade. To access articles and opinion pieces from partners in the Global Trade Series, and to listen to more episodes on global trade, visit www.aig.com/GTS or follow the AIG Global Trade Series wherever you get your podcasts. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.